for now, 9:05.
Hi, is that
Phil Holland?
Phil Holland. Yeah, okay. Oh, sorry, I'm a bit late, aren't I? I said I'd
right.
Bring it to 11. That's
so
okay.
Not all that late.
Oh, good. Right, okay. Okay.
I'm just going to ask you first of all, what is your telephone number?
Oh, right, okay. It's 01784.
Yeah.
246-428. Yep. Okay. Okay. The reason I've heard of you is I think it's either through Harold Hillman or through Ivor Catt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got you down as Walter Philip Holland.
Ah, yeah, well, I'm known as Phil.
Phil, right, okay. Very good. Of Egremont. In fact, I was going to. We were in the Lake District a couple of years ago, but I didn't feel empowered to kind of call around. Perhaps I should have done. I don't know.
Uh huh. Well, that's all right.
Anyway, are you retired actually? Is that your?
Oh, yes. I'm, what am I? 68, nearly 69.
What was your date of birth? 27, is that right?
27, yes.
Oh, right. That's a good guess, wasn't it? 27. I just, you know, that's just for getting background. You know, like the intellectual atmosphere, kind of.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Catt collects his sort of case studies, as he
that's
regards
right, yes.
But he's not very informative about them. I think he gives more attention to his own work.
Yeah,
so,
he's quite entertaining.
He's an interesting chap, yeah. he's got you down as inventing a hypothesis in physics, and so far as I could make any sense of what he said, it's about two more states of matter, plus something to do with some atomic theory.
Yes, basically that. The two most commonly observed states of matter,
right.
Are not mentioned in any physics book. I'll tell you what they are. You'll see what they are. You'll see them every day. The first state of matter that you'll see, you can see plenty today, are clouds. They are not water.
Yeah.
They're made of water, but they're not water liquid. They're not water gas. They are a different phase altogether.
Right.
Between water liquid and water gas.
Oh, right.
the hypothesis I used, this just dropped out. You know, it was a necessary part to fill in a gap in the hypothesis. A bit like Mendeleev's periodic table.
Right, you identified a...
In other words,
yeah.
I said, well, there should be this particular thing here which would have no directional degrees of order, that water doesn't have, liquids don't have. But unlike water, if you have two drops of water and put them together, they will stick together.
Yeah.
And you can't part them. But... if you have two grains of sand and you put those together, they will part.
Right.
Well, this material should be like that, but unlike grains of sand have three directions of degrees of order.
Hang on a second, a degree of order is like in crystallization or something?
A degree of order is just means to say there is order.
Like in a crystal or something?
Yes, like in a crystal, yes.
Right, okay.
That's the where it comes from. None of that, but if you put the two pieces together, they would come apart.
Yeah.
So a cloud doesn't become rain immediately.
Mm.
It has to have a phase change to become rain.
Yeah.
And that's why rain is not all common. In fact, the majority of clouds don't become rain.
Mm.
They just disappear.
Right.
But that's the one. Then the other one, which I don't deal with a lot, is the whole of biology is based on water.
Yeah.
But it is not water liquid.
Right.
It is not liquid water. It is quite different. And if when analysed the nuclear magnetic resonance, it is found to be of a different constitution.
Yeah.
And it is a separate phase.
You're not talking about something like water of crystallization?
No water of crystallization, no.
And you're not talking about hydrated ions, for example?
Nothing to do with the hydrated ions. It is the whole of water that comes in, the living matter, is different. And it, once again, has this characteristic that if you put two pieces of an amoeba together, which is really water, two pieces of amoeba water together, they will part. They also part. They don't stick together.
Yeah. But isn't there... Well, there's a membrane around it, isn't there?
Ah, that membrane, if you then analyse it, you will find it doesn't exist. That is what biologists have invented. It's a piece of invention.
That's interesting, right?
Yeah, you will find out there has never been an amoeba membrane. Now, I can tell you why people have invented that. They've invented things like surface tension. Think of membranes there, but there isn't one.
Can I just go back to a slightly different question? There's a so-called phase rule invented by Willard Gibbs.
That's right, yeah.
How does your system fit in with that?
Oh, it fits in with it perfectly. Willard Gibbs was one of the first ones that I analysed and found out that he had already put forward some of the things which were necessary for mine. As I say, it fits in perfectly with his idea.
Did you ever read Gibbs? I remember reading that Gibbs's paper on this was so kind of hard to read that it took three mathematicians sort of lots of work to actually work out the simple rule, something plus something equals something plus two. I forget what. Wasn't actually worked out by Gibbs. Somebody.
That's right. Yeah.
So have you read Gibbs? I mean, you've plowed through all this stuff.
No. I read it via. Willard Gibbs's. It is Willard Gibbs's book. Yes, I have read his book.
Oh right, so you've,
yeah.
Okay, so
I read his book. It is a very complicated book.
Okay.
But there are sections in it which, as far as I am concerned, are crystal clear.
Right.
There was no doubt he was on the right line.
So he had a prefiguring of this idea of other states of matter as well, did he?
Oh yes, yes. Right. In fact, the third one where. Thing pointed out should exist. When I first investigated this, I've investigated solids, liquids and gases, but of course there was one other group of phases which were called liquid crystals.
Yes.
And liquid crystals, it was always reported that there were three phases, but mine stated that there should only be two phases of liquid crystals. Because it's just a matter of degrees of order, directional degrees of order. A solid has three directions of degrees of order. You know that.
Yeah, just a second. The name of your hypothesis is called Endorec, isn't it?
No, Nendorec. Nendorec.
And that's got directional orders in it somewhere, isn't it?
Yes, so it's got order.
What's order
and resonance.
What is the... acronym
you want to work the acronym out in full.
Yeah.
It's quite simple. It's nuclei,
yeah,
which consists of everything that is a nucleus. Not just atomic nuclei, but atoms. The nucleus of a cell is a nucleus. The nucleus of a human being is a single cell.
Okay. That's
nucleus.
Would you count a seeded crystal in a cloud as being a nucleus?
Yes, I would. Okay. I'm just dealing with clouds at the present moment. But, well, a nucleus with an... And then the next one, if you write that on one line...
Okay, I've got
then
that.
Then with an equal number of degrees of order.
Right.
Now, equal number of degrees of order means to say it's similar. Similar nuclei.
Okay.
Not different nuclei. You can't have... the nucleus of an atom and muddle it up with the nucleus of a single cell.
Right.
Okay? You must keep the same types of order.
Okay, degrees of order. Degrees of order is similar to degrees of freedom in the Gibbs sense, is it?
Yes. I started off with degrees of freedom, but I found out after a very short time, there's probably the one difference between mine and Gibbs, is you can't measure freedom. You can measure order, but you can't measure freedom.
I see, so degrees of freedom is a misnomer, or confusing expression.
When you think about it, you try and measure degrees of freedom.
That's a very good point, actually, yeah.
You can measure degrees of order. In fact, the acronym started off with degrees of freedom. Then I wanted something to change, and I changed it to order, and then I realised, after probably years, that you can't measure freedom.
Right.
And you can't... and although mine in the early days talked about entropy, and I still do to some extent, you can't measure randomness, which is what entropy is about. What you can measure is a degree of order, and you can say that is less ordered than the other, but you can't say that is more random than the other. Because you can't measure randomness in the first case.
That's a good point. And the only reason you noticed that was because you changed the letter to make it into a nice word.
Yes, I just changed the letters to make it into a nice word, and then realised afterwards that I'd changed the letters into something that was more scientific than the previous one.
Hot stuff. Okay.
And then the next word is resonance, which means harmony.
Right.
Degrees of order, what have I got to? Degrees of order resonating in an electron cloud. Now, I now usually add one other word.
Right.
I add the word boundary.
Boundary.
Because it started off entirely in solids, and therefore electron clouds were okay. But really and truly, it was within a boundary. So just as you have a skin as your boundary,
right,
and an amoeba has a boundary, but it doesn't have a membrane. It has a boundary. It's rather like, let me explain the difference between an amoeba and you. You have a skin which is like the Berlin Wall. It is something physical and can be seen and measured.
Right.
Okay? But the 49th parallel is also a boundary. And
yes,
you can go to Canada and the USA and you cannot see a wall like the Berlin Wall.
Right, like the equator or something.
But there is a different set of laws on one side of the 49th parallel to the set of laws on the other side of the 49th parallel. Okay?
Yep.
And so that is basically the boundary round an enderec. Now, I must also just tell you another thing, that and we can compare it with countries in a moment, that a boundary in an enderec does depend on what you are looking at it with.
Right.
Let me explain. If you're looking at an enderec with X-rays,
right,
you will see in an atom, in the standard atom, I'll call it the standard atom, you see the nucleus.
Hmm.
Okay, if you're looking at it with light waves,
right,
you see
a sort of blur.
Blur, yes, it's a blur. But you can then look at it with infrared rays, and you cannot see it at all. You can only see molecules, in other words, groups of atoms.
Yes, I see.
Okay, so it depends what you're looking at it with. So let me take the illustration of a country to give you some idea of this. If you have got the United States, it has got a boundary, which we have talked about with the 49th parallel and the coastline and all the rest of it. All that boundary can be seen.
Mm.
And you have a set of laws inside that boundary which apply to everything inside that boundary. But you also have another boundary round Texas.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and you have a different set of laws.
Yes, states laws.
In other words, you have some laws which are entirely inclusive of everything.
Right.
And you have some more specific laws later on.
Right, you have a sort of subset or hierarchy.
In you have all your cells with the same nuclei inside the cells.
Mm.
Okay? But your liver is different from your kidneys.
Yeah.
Okay? And you have a boundary around your liver. People draw it. Yeah. People use it. And you have a boundary around your kidneys.
Okay.
So in other words, you get the point that sometimes you have bigger units and smaller units, but that's what the whole process is about.
Right, so you're splitting things up into sort of sets and subsets.
Yeah.
And so on. Hey, let me just ask you, you use the word nenderet. Are you using it as a... Nenderet, sorry. Are you using it as a... as a noun, you talk about a nenderec,
yes,
and that's a sort of structure which we're now explaining.
That's right.
Right,
now,
okay.
If I am not the first person to have used the word nenderec, in the sense that it has another meaning which you can see in the dictionary, but because...
You mean that's not a word that exists already, is it?
No. It does really, but I'll explain to you.
Oh, sorry.
The reason I didn't use the word that's in the dictionary, which is the true nenderec, is A, because it isn't as complete as what I tell you about, and NDEREC is an acronym which tells you a little bit about it. You're looking for nuclear,
yep.
You're looking for a boundary, you're looking for resonance, you're looking for degrees of order. Those are the sort
okay.
of things you're looking
for. Well, you also mentioned an electron cloud, and I presume that's not essential, is it?
Yes, the electron cloud is...
Is that essential to it?
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
that wouldn't apply biologically, would it?
Pardon?
That wouldn't apply biologically, would it?
In the biological term, the electron cloud is what we call cytoplasmic fuel.
Oh, right. So when so an electron cloud is really a metaphor for... It could be some other sort of cloud.
Any fluid that goes up to the boundary.
So rather than being an electron cloud, it could be a... Something being the cloud, a cloud.
Yes,
yes. Okay.
A cloud, yes. But of
Fair
course,
enough.
As I say, originally when I started it off, I was entirely interested in solid liquid.
Right, and then you've generalised it to other things.
And then I found it applied to biological terms as well.
That's
now, you're
you.
Now wondering what's the word. The word is atom. If
atom.
You look in a dictionary what an atom is,
mm.
and if you look in John Dalton's original papers, what an atom was, he talked of an atom of sugar.
Right.
And he meant the smallest part of sugar that you can have.
Yes, that's fair enough, isn't it?
Mm. Let me explain to you that how it's been distorted to atoms as we now think of them in science.
Right.
Let me give you two simple examples where it is obvious that the atoms we think of in science are wrong. Have you got a girlfriend?
Yeah.
You've given her a diamond?
No, not...
You haven't. Okay.
But
you
say,
could give
say,
her a diamond or you could give her soot.
Right.
And in science, they say that's identical.
Hmm.
But in John Dalton's terms, they weren't identical.
Right.
As an atom of carbon in diamond is a bigger unit. It's not a single atom.
Yes, that's what you mean. Yeah, right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more obvious that it's not a single atom C in graphite.
Right.
Okay? So, but what an atom is, it's something that when you cut it into two...
Yeah.
When you cut it into two, you have killed off the original.
Okay. Well, the Greek word atom actually means not cuttable, doesn't it?
Not cuttable,
yeah,
yes.
Right.
And that's what NDERECs are about.
Okay.
They are not cuttable.
Right, you're looking...
So, in other words, many times they are much bigger units. In fact, an elephant is an atom.
Yes, that's what
you
mean.
Because if you cut it in two, you don't have two elephants.
Right.
But if you get a grain of sand, the majority of grains of sand, if you cut them in two, they are two separate grains
right.
of sand.
So you could count, for example, a solar system, or in fact a whole galaxy as a NDEREC?
Oh yes, yes, but I don't tend to deal with that.
Okay.
The only part of the astronomical field that I deal with, which is interests me, is the sun.
Okay.
And in all science books, they will tell you the sun is all gas. I can tell you the sun is mainly solid.
Really?
And it has got an atmosphere around it, and in that atmosphere there are clouds, which you can see, because they are called granules,
yeah, granules.
By astronomers, and the other, more important bit, and the bit I'm particularly interested at present, are called sunspots.
Right.
And they are simply hurricanes. If you look at an astronomical picture of a hurricane, of a sunspot, and you look at a meteorological picture of a hurricane from a satellite, you will see that a sunspot and a satellite and a hurricane
okay.
are almost identical.
Is that the same as a cyclone or anticyclone?
The same as a cyclone, not an anticyclone. Same as a cyclone,
right.
but hurricanes, not tornadoes.
Do you think there's such a state of matter as plasma? I mean, that's sometimes talked about.
Plasma is only ionized gases, yeah.
That's all it is, an ionized gas, isn't it?
It's just an ionized gas, but the problem is, you see, that people think of gases as being a lot of cannonballs belting around in space.
Right.
They are not. They are simply balloons in which every atom, Dalton's system, every atom, and this is the word Dalton used, is an elastic piece of fluid. Every atom in a gas obeys PV equals RT. Not statistically. Every item in the gas obeys PV equals RT. In other words, so if you keep cutting a gas down, making it smaller and smaller, it will always obey PV equals RT, because the base unit of a gas is not a cannonball belting around in space. It is a little balloon which obeys PV equals RT. There is a slight reason why they deviate from PV equals RT, and that is because some of them are not gas. Some of the particles in the thing, and that is the basis of clouds.
Oh, I see.
In other words, there is another unit, and they just change it to that. It's a phase change. But only some of them, not all of them. But that's a different part of the story.
Okay, I'm more or less with you so far, I think.
Yeah, by the way, did you know of Andrews and his critical point?
Andrews and his critical point? Critical point, let me think. Critical point, I think it's another point where you have what's normally regarded as three phases all existing together, but only under one condition of temperature and pressure.
Very good, yes. That's called a triple point.
Triple point, yeah.
Triple point. But have you heard of the critical point of a gas?
I'm not sure.
I will read it out to you. And, it is the temperature above which a gas cannot be liquefied by pressure alone.
Oh, I have heard that then, yeah. That's why they use helium, isn't it, for low temperature experiments, that sort of thing.
Very good. Now, I will tell you that the man called Professor Andrews in the days of when Gladstone was Prime Minister, so it's a long time ago, and it is because of him that people think that the sun is all gas, made one vital mistake.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what his mistake was. He said the critical temperature is that temperature above which a gas cannot be liquefied by pressure alone. I've said that to you before.
Yeah.
I've repeated it. But what he should have said was the truth. The temperature above which a gas cannot easily, note the first word, easily, be seen, which doesn't mean cannot be,
right.
Cannot be seen to be liquefied by pressure alone.
Right.
If you are very, very careful with your experiment, you can actually see the liquid.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
And you can see the phase between gas and liquid. And indeed, Andrews, in his experiments, saw this phase. He saw the cloudy phase for a very short time in the experiment, and he said, that's just a bit of muck. And so, having got it into a bit of muck, you see, he hasn't seen it. But there you are, you see, the clouds were there in his experiment, and what's more, if you read his paper, he did report that above the critical temperature, it did appear he had liquid. It did appear that way to him, but
he dismissed it. He could not perceive it. He thought it was a mistake.
Because you see, he said it was mostly the same as the gas, because he couldn't see a boundary. You see, because he couldn't see a boundary, he said there was no boundary, which is a common thing. But there is a boundary between the tropopause and the stratosphere.
You
can't see it.
Can I just ask if you ever read a book by a chap called Ranson called Certainty and Uncertainty?
No, I haven't read that. I'm not a great reader.
Okay, I didn't
read that. I'm a specific reader more than a great reader.
It's just that he had a similar idea about meteorology.
Yeah, I dare say. I've just read Mason's book a second time.
I've got a tape recording of him giving a speech on global warming.
Oh, well, tell me, is he still alive?
Well, he was a year ago. He gave a lecture at Kew. Do you want a copy of the tape? I could send you one if you like.
Oh, very good.
I'm interested. I don't know if you want. It was about modelling global warming.
It's not my topic, but, you know, I take interest in many things.
The reason it interested me was because it showed how the scare was generated by, basically by them having an expensive computer which nobody else could check the results on, and using a very crappy computer model which assumed the amount of cloud formed was constant.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of warming, you know. And then they got a bigger grant and they refined the model at great cost.
Yeah.
And of course the amount went down. So, I mean, the whole work was completely, in my view, scientifically kind of null.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's not his way of presenting it, but that's my interpretation of what he said.
Yeah, very good.
Anyway, you said cloud. Do you call them clouds as a phase?
Oh, it is a phase.
Use the word cloud.
Totally different phase.
Okay.
It is.
What was the other example? You had another one which I've now forgotten. Was that membranes or something?
Oh, no. The other one is all biological matter. It's based on a different phase. But it does occur in other phases, because in the liquid crystal phase, which is where we started off at, the liquid crystals, there should have been only two varieties. There were three. But I found that two of the varieties were really the same. But because they were totally different aspects, people had given them a separate phases.
Right. This is
nowadays, in most liquid crystal things, which they aren't liquid crystals at all, they're fluid crystals. They're not liquid. Nothing to do with liquid. They're fluid.
What's the difference between liquid and fluid?
Well, the difference between liquid and fluid is a fluid is like salt and pepper and vinegar.
All together.
No, salt is one fluid,
yeah.
Pepper is another fluid, and vinegar is another fluid.
Oh.
But only vinegar is a liquid.
What is fluid about salt and all pepper?
Well, they flow, don't they?
They flow?
They flow. Most liquids flow.
When you say flow, you mean in bulk, in a pipe or something?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, well, there's salt and pepper on the table.
Okay.
Most solids are fluid. The common form of a solid is really a fluid.
Yes, that's
not, as Bragg would tell you, an infinite single crystal. Infinite single crystals are a misnomer. They don't exist at all.
Can I get this in some order? I'd like to discuss with you what you mean about the membrane and surface tension in biology. I'd also like to discuss how Kat got in touch with you and whether your work was suppressed and so on. And I'd also like to discuss what difference your way of viewing things makes to physics, or chemistry for that, or biology for that matter. Is that okay?
Yeah, well, go on, you'll fire away the question.
All right.
And I will answer.
What was your background? I mean, have you done physics and or chemistry? So you sound more...
I'm a chemist by thing. I went to Cambridge University and got a double first.
Oh, really? Was that Trinity?
No, I was at Queen's.
Oh, really? That's good. Now, that was in...
I was tutored by Lord Dainton.
1940 or something, is that right?
Yeah, well, 1945.
Oh, right. Spiffing.
Is my matriculation year, if you know how Cambridge was.
Yeah, right. Did you work in chemistry for the rest of your life?
Yes, I worked for Shell, a firm called Hixson & Welsh, or Hixson, as it is now known as, and I worked for the Atomic Energy Authority, and that became British Nuclear Fuel.
Let me ask you these questions in this sort of reverse order. If you're correct, what difference does your way of viewing things make to science and people?
As far as science is concerned, it opens up a totally new way of looking at it, just as Dalton's way opened up a totally new way of looking at things in his day. When he put forward the atomic hypothesis, notice mine's a hypothesis as well.
Yeah, right.
The different. Do you know the difference between a hypothesis and a theory?
Hypothesis and a theory.
Some people get them muddled up.
Well, I'd say a theory is tends to be just a collection of hypotheses. You know what I mean? Forming some sort of whole.
A theory is where you use it for prediction. You have a theory, and then you kind of have four dots on the line, and therefore you say, with this theory, the next dot will be here.
Right, so
and
it's...
then you check it out and see if it is there.
Right, so it's not very different from a hypothesis, except you're adding the extra...
No, in a hypothesis, a hypothesis, it doesn't matter if you then want the next dot in the line and you then find it doesn't fit, your theory is all right, because it works for the bit where you're using it. A theory can be quite okay, even if it's totally wrong, where you use it.
Can you give an example of that?
But a hypothesis is a much more philosophical thing, that if you find anything wrong with a hypothesis, any one item wrong,
then
the whole thing falls to pieces.
The whole thing's wrong. Why isn't that... Sorry, explain again why that's not true with a theory. Preferably give you
an example. A theory is where you're wanting for local prediction. And therefore, provided you say that this thing has an end here, that's all right. Your theory works in that period.
Okay. So, for example, let me think.
PV equals RT is the common one.
Yeah, I was thinking, sorry, I'd say the theory of gravity. What about the theory of evolution? Is there...
I don't even know what evolution is.
Do you count that as a theory?
I can't even find anybody who knows what evolution is, let alone... I know what change is, but I don't know what evolution is. And the survival of the fittest and all that gang are, to me, a complete anathema. But then I have read all six editions of The Origin of Species, and I class that as good literature, but not good science.
That's a spiffing point of view, I would say.
Yeah.
You don't think that...
They're only just so stories. I mean, say Darwin's Origin of Species is simply a series of just so stories, and it is a set of tales. The best one I enjoy is in the first edition, where Darwin looks at a bear swimming in a river in Canada. He quotes this: a bear swimming in a river in Canada with his mouth wide open, and he says, "Now, if that bear keeps swimming in that river with its mouth wide open, it will eventually become more monstrous than a whale." But by the time it comes to the second and third edition, that more monstrous than a whale has got missed out.
Oh, right. You've actually compared all the editions?
Oh, yes. I've read all six editions.
That's interesting.
There's a technique for doing this, but which makes life quite easy.
You don't use a scanner, do you? Something?
No. There is a book with it in.
Oh, a parallel text thing.
That's right.
That's interesting.
It's quite entertaining seeing how what is may in one book is fact in another, and what is fact in another edition, one of the earlier editions, is not fact in the later editions.
Right.
Study these things. It's really quite entertaining, but to think of the Origin of Species of a book of science is awful.
Good. Okay. So somebody's published a hefty volume with all six parallel texts in.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Oh,
I couldn't tell you who it is. It's been years since.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that.
I can tell you what it is. If you want to go to a librarian, they will be able to tell you. It's called the Variorum Edition.
Oh, right. Variorum. Yeah, that's good.
Variorum.
From the scientific... Let me just... This is a bit of a digression. I'd have thought from a scientific point of view, if you assume you've got organisms which reproduce, okay, and yet the reproduction thing is not 100% accurate, then inevitably you get variations, and inevitably some of them do better than others. I mean, I think that's fairly, isn't that, wouldn't you count that as a theory or a hypothesis?
Well, the snag is, I came across this early in my life. I was at London Gliding Club, learning to glide.
At Lasham, was that?
Huh?
Was that at Lasham?
No, London London Gliding Club is Dunstable Downs.
Oh, right.
Near Whipsnade.
Hey, you didn't meet George Spencer Brown, did you? He got a gliding blue.
No. Okay. I couldn't glide. Eventually, I decided it just isn't my cup of tea. But... I met a man called Frank Foster. He was the world gliding champion at the time in the two-seater gliders, and he was a most charming young man. I was privileged to meet him, really. He was just having a couple of days holiday during the week I was there at the London Gliding Club, and the one thing he said, and it had always, he said, if you're in an aeroplane or a glider, the one thing to avoid is meeting another one.
Yes.
Don't meet one up in the air, only on the ground. And he had gone off on a little trip in his glider and come back again, a very efficient glider. But I was sorry to see in the newspapers, probably 3 or 4 years later, that he was flying a Viscount over a passenger plane full of passengers between London and Rome, and just about at Rome he met an Italian fighter plane, and it just ran into him. Of course, the fighter plane had an ejector seat, so the pilot was saved, but Frank, who was a most wonderful fellow, with all his passengers, died.
All his passengers as well?
Oh, yes. Right.
Viscount.
Oh, Viscount aircraft.
Yes, of
full
course.
Air, full of people, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Sorry, I was thinking of that.
So, and yet, you see, when it came to thinking of who was the fitter of the two, you know, he was much fitter than I was.
Oh, that's a different issue, really. But anyway,
well, no, it isn't, is it? You begin to wonder on these sort of things, and you know, all these things on this biological tale of evolution are tales.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough. I'm still not exactly clear. You know, the people that I speak to are more interested in distinguishing between hypotheses and findings. They think that's the question they put. Do you know the difference between a finding and a hypothesis? Because that's very important in biology, isn't it? Because in biology textbooks, you constantly get hypotheses put forward as though they're facts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like,
yes, it's very easy to do.
Mm, it's very difficult to avoid,
yeah.
That's right.
Oh, very, you know, people.
Okay, now let me return to this question. What effect, you say that it would have an enormous effect, like Dalton's atomic theory, on the way physics...
Well, on the way you look at things. I mean, say, you look at a cloud, and obviously meteorologists have looked at clouds,
yeah.
And they've always thought they are drops of water. But they aren't drops of water at all. I mean, say, and you can tell this, because if they were drops of water, there'd be rainbows all over the place. But there aren't rainbows all over the place. You only get rainbows with rain.
When you say it's a different state of matter, you mean it is literally something new, like glue or ice or something. It's just up there in its own little structure.
Yes, it is a different phase of matter.
Are you sure it's not a colloid or something like that?
Well, no, it's not a colloid. A colloid, again, something different.
Well, it was something like that, you know, i.e. lots of tiny little bits of water which behave in a way, because they're so small, perhaps, they don't...
No, it is just a different phase, and from an Enderic hypothesis, it has to exist. It has to be there, you know. I look for it. I didn't realise clouds were this particular phase. I found it in other phases.
Why is it if you walk through low-flying clouds, low clouds, you get damp?
Why when you walk over the hills you don't get damp either? that's the point, you see. Now, when they want to find out about the size of particles in a cloud,
yeah.
They fly something in and they say, oh, well, they're this size. But it always has to be something which changes the cloud into the liquid phase.
Right. You mean if you look at it under a microscope?
By the time you look at it, it's liquid phase.
You're saying that if you get a microscope and just kind of stick it in the middle of a cloud, you won't see anything?
No, you don't.
Mm.
They've tried this out hundreds of times.
Yes.
they always get a blur. They don't get nothing.
I see what you mean. So I understand exactly what you're saying. I think what you're saying is if you look at water or ice, it's obviously different. You can sort of see straight away that it's different.
That's right, yeah.
If you look at a cloud, it looks like, I don't know, it looks as though it's up in the air, it looks as though it should be something.
That's right. And for years I thought it was quite high density, you know, just less than water. You know, less than 1 gram per cc.
Hmm.
But just recently I was doing some work and I realised that was another misnomer I'd been running up against. Density must be somewhere... about 0.01 gram per cc, or even probably 0.001 gram per cc.
How does that compare with air?
Not far off, that's why it floats.
Does it? Are you saying?
In other words, it's nothing to do with up currents. It doesn't come down because it can't come down.
Are you saying if you look into a cloud, is there no air inside it at all?
Oh no, there's plenty of air inside it. The water phase is only a very small percentage of it.
Well, but if you've got something like ice, there's no air mixed in with it, is there? Or water? It's just
in ice and water. Well, ice falls down, it's called snowflakes, and water falls down, it's called rain.
Yeah.
But clouds don't fall down.
Yeah, what I was saying is, if it's a phase, shouldn't it be 100% its own material without any mixture or anything else in with it?
How do you mean? There are no mixture in a cloud.
Well, it's not just, if you look at a cloud, it's not just water, it's not just a phase of water.
It's a phase of water.
With no air mixed in with it.
No, it's diluted with air.
Well, how can it be diluted with air?
Well, because the air's all around it.
I mean, if you've got a phase like ice, right, is it possible to make a cloud?
Like, I've got a...
Is it possible to make that phase of water 100% water?
Oh, yes, you can have it 100%.
Well, like in a cloud chamber?
No, you don't do it there. You can have the place it's done, I can tell you where it's done. And you can see it. In fact, there's it's done on a few things. The one I like is the Draco Sea Power Station, which you've probably never heard of.
Draco Sea?
Sea, which is near Burton-on-Trent.
Is that related? There was one called Drax, wasn't there? Was
No. That Drax is quite different.
Yeah.
Drax is a normal power station. Draco Sea was going to be the power station of the future. It isn't the power station of the future, because they couldn't make it work. But it's called a supercritical power station.
Hmm.
And during the... and it works on a different principle. It doesn't have a steam drum in it. You convert it direct from water through the intermediate phase and direct on to steam.
So this is a small experimental one, was it?
Well, hardly small. a few hundred megawatts or a few thousand megawatts. I forget which, but it's...
Well, that's big. You mean
it's quite... It's a big one. It's actually a power producer.
It's actually working.
It was. I don't know whether it still is. The last I heard, it was still working.
It was very
difficult to work.
What's it used for fuel?
It used to salt up like nobody's business.
What did it use for fuel? I'm not quite with you here.
Fuel?
Yeah.
It was coal-fired.
And what happened to the steam that came off? I presume it made steam.
It's not made in electricity, just the same as anybody else.
And I see, so it wasn't using a turbine or some other...
Oh, yes, it used turbines. Turbines to make the electricity.
Right. So
just fed into a high pressure. It was very much higher pressure.
Oh, right.
And being many much higher pressure, it was much more difficult to work mechanically.
Oh, right, you're saying that it was like...
But it is a supercritical one. The other one is that there are quite a number of things where they're doing extractions with CO2, and they talk of it as supercritical fluids. Now, some of these supercritical fluids are certainly just liquid CO2, above the critical temperature.
Mm.
But it's still liquid. But some of the experiments are where they aren't using the liquid phase, they are actually using this other phase, what I call the multimer phase.
The what?
I call it the multimer phase.
Multimer?
That was just to stop it having giving it a name.
Right, multimer, by analogy with polymer or something.
By analogy with polymer, but a polymer is where it sticks together. A multimer is where it's got big numbers but doesn't stick together.
Right, that's what you mean, I think.
And that type of material uses it, but I've actually seen the phase at 100% in some little experiments I did in a laboratory. I could make it.
Do you have equipment where you live now?
No, I don't have the equipment where I live now.
So let me just get through it.
I can tell you how to do it.
All right. Well, just a second. In this power station, if you look at this extremely high-pressure steam, you're saying that's 100% in the sort of cloud phase without it?
Only part way down the system.
Where it's just sort of evaporated completely,
Before it's become steam, and where it's left being liquid.
Right. By the way, are you saying the stuff that you see coming out of a kettle is partly, is the same sort of stuff as a cloud, it's partly phase, it's a different phase, multimer phase water?
Yes. Right. The white stuff, the cloud bit, is cloud.
Okay.
I'll tell you the little experiment you can do this. Yeah, have you got an ordinary what I would call a standard kettle that is not one of these vertical contraptions but one of these more like horizontal contraptions?
What, with a spout at one end?
With a spout at one end.
Unfortunately, I've got the
tall one.
Unfortunately, I've got the tall contraption.
I will tell you the experiment to do.
Yeah.
And you can then come across the multimer phase in two ways.
Okay.
You fill the kettle full of water and turn on the power.
Right.
And you then put your ear to the kettle.
Right.
Okay? This is the first part of the job. Put the ear to the kettle and you will hear nothing.
Well, to start with.
Mm. To start with, yes. And then after a little while it starts to sing.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
But it doesn't boil.
Yes, that's true.
It sings but doesn't boil. And then it stops singing and boils.
Mm.
And you will notice it does stop singing and it boils.
It's not just that the sound of the boiling masks
No,
it
isn't. The sound of the... initially you will think, it's the sound of the boiling that's overcoming the singing.
Right.
But after a while you will be able to pick out that it actually the singing stopped.
Okay.
And the boiling has taken over. Now, when it's singing, what it amounts to... And this is where you are going to think that this is very, very peculiar. What it amounts to is that the multimer phase is being formed, but it is unstable and sinks back into the liquid phase.
Right.
And it is that making of the multimer phase and then sinking back into the liquid phase that gives the singing effect. Now, the next part of the thing is you then have the spout opposite a pan of cold water. So in other words, the spout, and then you have a little gap, say 3 inches, between the pan of cold water and the spout. In that gap you see the cloud.
3 inches gap, yeah, okay.
In the gap you see the cloud. But when it gets to your pan of cold water, you will see that it becomes very fine drops. Okay, a big pile of fine drops.
Yeah.
Now that is liquid.
Right.
The cloud bit is the bit in between, and the liquid, and you will notice the difference between the liquid that you see and the cloud that you see is the cloud is opalescent.
Yes.
And the liquid is clear.
Right.
And then what you notice, and this is why you can't do it for a long time, then what you notice is that the liquid starts joining together and making what's equivalent to raindrops.
Drops, yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm now going to tell you something that you will find almost difficult to believe.
Okay.
In fact, when I found it myself, I found this incredible.
Okay.
So I'm now going to tell it to you, and you will find it incredible, that when you boil water, you do not convert water liquid into steam gas.
Hmm.
When you boil water, you convert water liquid into the multimer phase.
Right.
But the multimer phase is so unstable at that point that it immediately changes into the gas phase.
Right. When you say immediately, you mean kind of...
Within a...
tiny fraction of a second.
A nanosecond, more like.
Right, so you can't see it...
You can never
above
see
above the surface
it,
of... Yeah.
And likewise, when you condense steam, it always goes through the multimer phase before it becomes liquid.
Right.
And that's very often when you see the cloud. your schoolboy's experiment of distilling water, you used to see a little bit of cloud just before it condensed. And that's it. Now, the funny thing is that I've told you about that. I'll now tell you, which is an equally incredible one, and again I found it difficult to believe, but I can assure you it's correct, that when you freeze water, and any other liquid, you do not make solid ice.
Not straight away.
It goes through another phase. And when you melt ice, and this is more incredible still, it also goes through this other phase, but in actual practice, when you melt ice at 0 degrees centigrade, the surface temperature of the ice drops to about minus 17.
Does it?
And then it becomes, and then that bit changes into liquid water.
What is the intermediate phase between ice and water?
This is the same phase as all biology is made up of.
Oh, right. So you've got, okay, so you've got two water phases. Right.
It's purely based on degrees of order. This particular phase is another degrees of order phase, no degrees of geometrical order phase.
Okay. I asked you earlier what effect this has, and you compared it with Dalton's atomic theory, but surely it's different, isn't it? Because if this is right, you've got new... It's a sort of perceptual thing. You know, with Dalton, it opened up the idea of, you know, analysing stuff and getting atomic structure and molecules.
That's right, yes. Well, this does.
Does it?
This does, yes. And once you use this, you will find out that such things as quarks and all that lot...
You think that's all rubbish?
...are all entirely imaginary. There is an alternative.
Oh, that's interesting. I did wonder about that.
Which doesn't require the complications of quarks and all the rest of them.
Okay, let me ask you another question.
But, again, that's a different story.
Let me ask you abstractify this a bit. If you've got, I mean, presumably what causes phases is things like, you know, van der Waals forces or whatever, you know, the sort of stuff at the top.
You might think so.
Well, I'm all right, maybe I'm wrong then. But what I mean is, I would have thought that if you've got several, you know, if you look at the way, okay, we take as given that there are some physical laws and that they sort of do various things.
Yeah.
And presumably, if you knew enough about them, you could infer that there must be, for example, solids, you know, when they're clotted together closely enough, and liquids or whatever. So presumably, if you knew enough about all these forces, like van der Waals forces or something, you could infer all the phases of matter, couldn't you? They must all be consistent with... There must be something holding them together. Okay. Does that make any sense to you? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, it does, and it's... Purely and simply the ways we're taught. We're taught all about these forces.
Do you think they're constructed back to front from what is noticed?
That's right, yes. Right. There's a lot of it. A lot of my modelling of solids, liquids and gases could be done with what I will call Velcro techniques. In other words, jigsaw techniques, three-dimensional jigsaws.
Right, just hooks.
In other words, a solid is a solid, basically because the individual bits of it are held together in a jigsaw. In other words, they're all individual bits, okay?
Yeah.
Take a bit, and you can even take a bit out altogether, and the jigsaw will still hold together.
Yeah.
You get the idea, and don't forget, once you've got it in three dimensions, it really does have a much bigger holding capacity.
Right.
And so mine is basically basically looks at shapes and says that solids have got shape to them, and the lattice idea, which I started off with, of course, because everybody else had told me about this lattice, the lattice doesn't really exist. And in fact, what I liken it to is you probably live in a house which is made of bricks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or breeze blocks.
And you can have it any old shape. Yeah, you can have it any old shape, Right, putting the brakes in a different order, can't you? You know, well, you can build...
Consistent with gravity holding it together, yeah.
Yes, but you only have a little bit of glue on the side, but if all your bricks were Velcro type, they'd stick together.
Mm.
You get the idea? Well, what I've found is that all things in nature are basically shaped. The shape is much more important. In fact, you know, this is a degree of order.
I see what you mean. Hey, can I just make a little point here? There's a friend of mine who's got an alternative theories in biology.
Yeah.
Some of which are a mixed bag. One of the things he came up with is what he called a five-hook theorem. He says if you've got a biological thing with one hook, then you can just form a little thing. If it's got two, you can get a string.
Yeah.
If you've got three, you can get a sheet.
Yeah.
If you've got four, you can get some sort of three-dimensional thing. If you've got five, you get cancer because it kind of it proliferates. Is that vaguely connected to what you're saying?
Maybe right or maybe wrong. I don't with the biological side,
okay,
side of it. It did remind me of a wonderful story which you have to be more of a solid geometry fanatic. But
okay.
It is a wonderful story about how things can't do. It's a book called Flatland.
Flatland.
You've read it?
The Reverend somebody.
Yeah,
yes.
A square. But that is part of my problem, you see, is telling people about it. You see, he was trying to tell people about three dimensions when he was only in two.
Yes, right.
But I often take great courage out of the fact that although I know my ideas are quite different to what other people are, and the difficulty is that you have been brought up in the wrong way.
Right.
You know, I tell people that, you know, The Origin of Species is just a mere novel. And they get very upset, and I say, generally then say, well, have you read it? And they say, no. Well, what can I do when I've read all six editions of it?
Oh,
I can tell you there's only 900 sentences out of the 3,600 sentences in the original book that managed to survive to get to the sixth edition.
A quarter of them.
Only a quarter, all the rest had to be altered
well,
in
were,
some way or other.
That's an illustration of evolution in action, isn't it?
Well, yes. If there is such a thing as evolution, you see, I would just say it's a measure of change. Somebody had a different thing. The other one where mine is
Do, can I ask
different
if you, can I just ask you another thing? Do you believe in four when I was young, I remember seeing stuff in relation to Flatland, and there was an idea that there was an idea that there was a thing called a tesseract,
yeah,
a four-dimensional cube. I always thought that was highly nonsensical.
Well, yes, Nendrex really looks at these things, but what it is, it looks at them in a different way.
Right.
If you look at something, it depends how you're looking at it. And so, although I talk of three directions of geometrical order,
right.
There are many other forms of order. One simple form of order is number. What do I mean by number? Well, you see, if you've got something that's no directions of geometrical order, that is like a blob of liquid, you can have two blobs of liquid, and you can say, oh, well, that blob of liquid is different to the other blob of liquid purely and simply by the order of number. In other words, one drop has got, shall we say, 10 to the 6th atom molecules of water in it, and the other has got 10 to the 8th molecules of water in it.
One's 100 times bigger than the other.
One's 100 times bigger than the other. In other words, it's got a different degree of order.
Hmm.
The fact it's got other things of the same doesn't matter. In other words, order is a number as well. And this is particularly important with clouds. You'll have a lot of different clouds because, although they've no geometrical order of any of the multimers in them, which is what I use, the term I use,
yeah.
a cloud that's made up of, shall we say, multimers with 10 to the 6 molecules of water in it is different to a cloud that's made up with
right.
a thing. And what I have just recently observed is I noticed that they change colour as well. Hence, of course, my original little point about the diamond and the graphite. That if you look at clouds, they're not all the same colour either.
Isn't that just to do with incident light on them?
It has nothing to do with incident light. I thought it was, but having got my eyes opened to the fact that it might not be, I can tell you that it's nothing to do with incident colour, which was what I thought in the first case. So see, if you look at clouds, the ones I've seen, I mean, obviously I'm a limited viewing point, mainly greys and whites.
Right.
But there's white, light grey, and dark grey, and very dark grey, easily observed.
And that's nothing to do with them being thick clouds and therefore shadowed.
No, I thought that until I eventually saw the
you saw the light
move away, and there was the shadow by itself. And you can see this any day you like.
You can see a cloud shadow without a cloud.
Yeah, I'd always thought it was a shadow, but you know, just looking, I found out, hey, that isn't due to the shadow at all. It's come out. The shadow's left the cloud. It's almost like Peter Pan. You know, he had a shadow that fell off, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, although I can't.
But the other one where mine is, again, as I said, in liquid crystals, they are actually fluid crystals,
right,
not liquids at all.
Right, you mean they're made of little particles which orientate
that's
themselves?
Right, they're made of individual little particles, and that's why the liquid crystal displays work.
Right.
They're actually made of quite sizable little particles.
And they float in some in liquid they're not soluble in, so to speak.
They're no, they just float on themselves. They're fluid, like the fluid in your salt.
Oh, I see.
When I first told people this, they said, "Oh, well, it's the air in the salt that makes it flow." I said, "Yeah, I'll make you one with a vacuum, and I'll show you that it works." You know, the ordinary egg timer.
Right. So you're saying in liquid crystals, they just happen to be they're little round crystals or something, which are polarized, so the electricity.
Yeah, they actually aren't round. That's the one thing they are.
Well,
what it is one has one type of liquid crystal which is used in most displays has what's called 1 degree of geometrical order.
Hmm.
1 degree of geometrical order.
You mean
in other words, it hasn't got the it's only got an x-axis, but it hasn't got an x and y-axis.
You mean it's
and if you remember your Flatland story,
yeah,
you remember he had this one, you know, the line man. You remember the
yes,
line man in the story?
Very dangerous.
And then there's the other type of liquid crystal, which has got two directions of geometrical order. This isn't as used as much, but it is used. I'll tell you where it's most commonly used, in the displays you have for temperature.
Hmm.
You know, those temperature
in fridges and so on.
Sensors. Well, this is the basis of those, with two directions of geometrical order. And then when you get the third direction of geometrical order, it's a solid.
I just remember that Abbott was the author of Flatland, wasn't he?
I couldn't tell you.
Abbott.
I'm sorry, I always
remember
I'm telling
you.
I'm
telling you
instead. By A square. And I read it in one of these parchment editions.
Oh, right.
I don't know whether that's the one you had, but
let me clarify this. You're saying that a cloud is not like ice 100% a particular phase. You're saying it's sort of diluted with air in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the same way that snowflakes are. Kind of. So it's made of little bits, presumably in some sort of shape determined by physical laws, I don't know.
Well, yes.
Is that impossible to say?
That's our point. It has no geometrical shape. There's no directions of geometrical order.
Hmm.
In other words, I'll tell you what it is like, and you can now see this. You can see this. It is like an amoeba.
Right.
Or even like, if you imagine an ordinary snowflake, which it becomes when it becomes solid, it's like that. It's all rounded. A set of fingers. Look at your hand.
Right.
And just imagine that floating in the sky. With, unlike what I thought, it had a density of 1 gram per cc, but it doesn't. Imagine it. Your hand in the sky with only 0.001 of a gram per cc.
Right.
And air is 0.001 of a gram per cc.
So if that
I have just a feeling it's near a 0.001.
So if that freezes, it shrinks considerably, doesn't it?
And when it freezes, it shrinks
by about 1% or something.
But it gets directions of order.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, with that, in a snow crystal, a snow crystal is, in my opinion, the perfect single crystal, because it has a centre of symmetry, and it has symmetry in the six directions, hexagonal symmetry. But I will tell you one thing, I did watch snowflakes melting under a microscope one day, snow crystals melting under a microscope. And I will tell you one thing, that when it melts isotropically, as distinct from anisotropically, and you know what I mean by the difference between isotropic and anisotropic.
I've got a vague idea.
Well, isotropic means it's the same in all directions.
Right.
Anisotropic means it's different in one direction to another.
How could that happen? That sounds... Do you mean something externally imposed or something?
It's something externally imposed.
Right, in other words, it's like a hairdryer or something, blowing on one side of it, is that what you mean?
Yeah, a hairdryer blowing on one side. So in other words, I did this out in the open air. I was jolly cold, but while I watched it melting, I saw what, in my opinion, was the most wonderful thing. When a snowflake melts, it melts at 24 places all at once. And it doesn't melt, and this is where we go back to your book by Gibbs. If you read through, you will find he says it melts. He imagined the things to be an oscillating process. I can't remember exactly where in the book it is, about page 324 or so, because it was a big book. But it melts in an oscillating process, and that's what I observed in the snow crystal melting.
Right. So you have to have some such hypothesis to account for it.
That's
apparently
right,
controlling
the electric hypothesis accounts for it beautifully, because you see it is all based on orders and symmetries and things like that.
Hey, can you tell me why it's flat? Why isn't it, if you've got a sort of thing like an amoeba?
Oh, it's based on the oxygen molecule. The oxygen molecule is also flat, or should I say, the nucleus of the oxygen atom is flat.
I see.
The nucleus of the oxygen atom. So this goes back as to if you talk of quarks and all that lot, they're all in round balls, but in an Enderic hypothesis, the structure of the nucleus of the atom is actually all based on tetrahedra.
That's
and
because,
indeed, you will find the structure of a periodic table as given by Mendeleev is all a geometrical progression. I made models of it, beautiful models, to show that the periodic system is simply a geometrical progression of tetrahedra building up on top of one another.
Really? Sounds a bit like Kepler.
Yeah, I suppose you could say it like Kepler, but yes.
I don't understand what you mean by tetrahedra building up. I mean, you've got this... the way it's normally described, you've got this inner shell of two electrons, haven't you? Then 8, then 8, then 18.
Well, yes, those are all imaginations. The difference between my hypothesis and what you find in books is basically it says the periodic table, or a periodic table, which is what Mendeleev said it was, is based on geometry, and is not geometry of the electrons, but geometry of the nucleus of an atom.
I see.
And in fact, if we really wanted to know what the nucleus of an atom was like, what we would have to do is to study the periodic table more carefully.
Right, rather than try and look at it.
Rather than try and bash it up and break it up and so forth. But it certainly has nothing to do with spheres.
Right.
Spheres are to do with the liquid phase.
Okay. Let me ask you. Okay, you said. All right. You compared the effect your theory would have to.
Oh yes, I was just going to tell you one other major difference, which is a rather funny one, because people get very very upset about this, because they've all heard of quantum liquids, you see, and have you heard of superfluid helium?
Superfluid helium and superconductors. Yes, I've heard of them. I'm a bit sceptical.
Superfluid helium.
I suppose they kind of crawl up the side of the vessels, isn't it?
That's right. He says crawls up. In actual practice, he goes down. It's all imagination that goes up. And in fact, superfluid helium is made by cooling ordinary liquid helium into a low temperature, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it goes through a phase change. Now, if you cool water, forgetting what I've told you about, would you expect to find a solid ice?
Yeah. Would I? Well, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah. And all superfluid helium is, it is the simplest of all solids.
Oh, why isn't it solid then?
No, well, no. Why isn't it rigid is what you're saying.
Oh, right.
Now, the salt in your salt pot is fluid.
Hmm.
And this is just the same. It's a powder.
Very fine powder.
A very, very, very fine powder. It flows through the most incredibly small holes. And when you get your salt and pepper, they flow through small holes. But the one thing that doesn't flow through a small hole is the vinegar. If you put a small hole in a vinegar bottle, you can't get the vinegar out. And an egg timer will not work with water. It only works with sand.
So, does that mean that all fluids are solid and all solids are fluid?
All solids can be made into fluids.
Right.
And most liquids are also fluids, but they're of a different type of thing altogether.
Okay.
But superfluid helium is nothing but solid helium. And some of the funny effects, the bit about climbing up and going over the side, is all entirely sublimation, which solids do. And in case of sublimation, it sublimes on the other side. Now, did you ever do that nice little experiment at school whereby you put a tube of ether in a vacuum flask, a vacuum container,
thing,
and you set it into water?
And, unfortunately, no.
Oh, I see. Well, if you put a tube of ether into a beaker of water...
That's sealed up, is it?
And then you pump down the vacuum on the outside.
Right, it starts to boil.
The ether boils, and the water freezes.
Right.
Well, all that happens in the famous experiment of superfluid helium is that the superfluid helium in the middle evaporates, and to provide heat for its evaporation, the helium on the outside condenses. And so it appears as if though it's gone right through the glass. So the people who saw this experiment said, oh, well, no, it must go up and over.
Right, so they've got
to... they didn't say, it just goes into the vapour phase and condenses out of the vapour phase back into the liquid phase.
Has that been...
the solid phase again.
Does that experiment still appear... I mean, I heard that at least 30 years ago. Does that experiment still figure in...
Oh, yeah.
...official physics?
Figures. But that's how it... all it is only sublimation.
Oh, God. Tell me, is your idea of... another phase for biological water, the same kind of thing? Are you saying that water goes into a kind of powder?
Yes.
In biological systems?
Yes.
And that has special properties which...
Yeah, but it's a powder. There's the full size of a cell.
Oh.
It's not a fine powder. It's quite a sizable chunk.
Are you saying that's why cells are the size they are, roughly speaking?
Yes, that's why cells are the size they are. And why an amoeba... An amoeba is, of course, the best one to look at. You see, if you look at an amoeba, you think it's got a membrane around it, but it hasn't. And if you watch an amoeba very carefully, you will find it all works in jerks. What it does is it converts a little bit of the next bit of water into its type of water and joins up with it, and it leaves a bit of its other part, because now it's too big, it's unstable, because it's not... it can't resonate together, a little bit drops off. And when the little bit drops off of an amoeba, you can still see it for a time, and then after a bit it just disappears.
Cool,
it converts into the other type, the ordinary water.
Oh. An extraordinary theory.
No, it isn't a theory, that's an observation.
Yeah, I'm trying to...
There's a lot of difference between theory and observation.
Yeah, I'm trying to sort of factor it in, so to speak. How do you, what do you, if you look under a microscope, you do you certainly, an optical microscope, you appear to get a boundary, or is that just because you would do it?
Yes, you appear to, because it's a different degree of order, it's not the same as ordinary water.
Right. So you get a refraction effect or something?
Yeah.
God, haven't you?
Yeah.
What about other things? What about cells in plants which have got woody and wood on the outside?
Well, yes, that's like the Berlin Wall.
Right. What about cells in... What about blood cells? What do you count them as?
Well, what you need to be able to do is to get hold of all the facts, and I haven't bothered with those.
Oh, well, it's not that easy, is it, unfortunately?
No.
Because they're all mixed up with hypotheses and mistakes and things.
Yeah.
An amoeba. That's an ingenious idea. What about how it eats and one of the big problems with cellular biology is how stuff gets into it, a thing, and out of it, and how it controls what goes in and out. And they've got rather fantastical theories about, you know, channels and iron.
Oh, yes, of course. Once you put a membrane around, you've got an awful business, haven't you? Once you find out there is no membrane, there isn't any problem.
So things will just sort of diffuse in?
No,
well,
they don't do it that way. I can tell you how this works. I've told you about it converting the water nearby, and you will find it works on a jerky basis.
You can see that.
You can see that, yes.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yes, you can see that bit. Well, what it does with food... say there's a little bit of food nearby.
Okay, there are two things I have to distinguish. One of them is a particle of food, but the other one is just dissolved stuff like salt or, you know, potassium ions or something. They're two different things, aren't they, presumably?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, but to get the food part of it, let me just explain to you what happens. It changes the water that's round that bit of food into the same water as itself, and it does this by... kind of, talking to it. In other words, it changes it at a distance. It isn't attached to it. Mm. It changes it at a distance. And then, all of a sudden, in the twinkling of an eye, it amalgamates up with it because it's the same degree of order as itself.
A bit like drops of water combining.
Well, a bit like, exactly the same as drops of water combining. And then, the food is now... detached from the main part of the water, and it's like a spider. It's got it in its net web, and it just gradually absorbs it, whatever is needed, and it works within the cell itself. The actual bit of taking the food is actually a very rapid process. It just goes in the twinkling of an eye.
Oh, really, like a tongue of a chameleon shooting out.
Exactly. Same principle.
When you say it talks to it, I mean, I presume you mean it does something, it resonates or something?
It resonates with it. In other words, it gets it on its same wavelength.
The temperature and so on has to be right for all this, I presume. It wouldn't.
That's right. Pressure, temperature, all these sort of things all have to be very, very similar. And you'll find this in all aspects of things.
That's an absolutely stunning theory.
It's mainly observation. As I say, the hypothesis just says, well, this should happen, and if you cool superfluid, if you cool liquid helium, you should get a solid.
Right. What about if you've got this particular type of water? Do dissolved substances behave as they do in a test tube, or would they not do that? They wouldn't diffuse so easily, presumably, would they?
No. Test tube water is different from living water.
Right. So have you any comments on the way, salt or something diffuses around or moves around inside a cell? I mean, the whole...
No, I haven't studied that. I don't deal very much with the biological side.
Because the other
side is much more interesting to my way of thinking. Well, having been brought up as a chemist, I'm more interested in these things that are associated with steam and... things of that nature.
Well, that sounds more like physics to me than chemistry. That sounds more like physics to me than chemistry.
Well, you might think so. I'm a physical chemistry, let's put it that way.
Well, physical chemistry is also that has to do with things like diffusion and membranes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I don't deal with much on that line.
Okay. Have you been into all the stuff about semi-permeable membranes and stuff? Does your theory have something to say about that? Because that figures
all. Basically, all those are when I've investigated them. First of all, one was told about osmosis at school until you saw that a 100-foot tree would never work by that. So obviously, the way the water gets up a tree is a totally different system. On an indirect hypothesis, it's quite straightforward. It's simply a set of pumps. Each cell resonates with the next one as it passes the water up, and a tree as a whole is one dendritic, isn't it? It's basically one dendritic because it works as a whole.
What's the nucleus of a tree?
Well, the single cell in the tree, which is quite complicated, isn't it? But a tree, once again, like all living matter, all the cells have the same chromosomes in the nucleus.
Yeah, but that's not necessary to your hypothesis, presumably, is it? Because if that hadn't been discovered yet, I mean, your theory would still presumably be true.
Deals with that. But what I found on all these semi-permeable membranes and so forth is basically they are only very fine filters.
Yes.
Just super fine.
Right, so some things, you accept that some things get through and some don't.
Some things get through and some things don't.
And there's just a sort of random mixing that makes it look as though it's deliberate.
That's right, in actual practice, reverse osmosis processes and so forth that they use for making pure water. It is basically making a very, very fine filter.
Right. Hey, look, we've been talking about an hour and a bit. Can I carry on for a bit longer and then...
Yeah, because I'm wanting to go out.
Do you have any of this written down? Have you got a...
Yes, I've got one or two things I've written in the past. I've got little bits on liquid crystals, as I say, or what I call them liquid crystals because everybody calls them liquid crystals, but in actual practice they're fluid crystals. Superfluid helium, why that's just too obvious that it's a solid phase and not a liquid phase. I also have produced thing that I call order without chaos. This was shows. I think I take six examples of why single crystals aren't single crystals. Why an amoeba has no
membrane.
The critical point one in. The critical point is really a thermodynamic triple point. But he does a number of these things.
And clouds as well, of course.
And shows. And I just give six different examples of things. There was one about. I generally stretch the point. To something else. I think one is about the spectra of atoms. Now, in the spectra of atoms, the tail is, and I'll say it's the tail, is of electrons jumping from A to B.
Yeah, and spin.
And spins going this way and that way.
And there's also this 1/n² kind of series.
Yeah. I mean, say it only works for one thing, and so forth. It doesn't work for anything else.
It's a fiddle.
It's just a mathematical fit, for one particular series. Well, I point out that you can get the same answer by assuming that inside an atom, that's the conventional atom as distinct from Dalton's original atom, the conventional atom, with its nucleus and electrons going supposedly going round and round it. If you say that is basically a resonating unit, it has all sorts of resonances in it.
Right.
And all you're doing is exciting these and measuring them.
Right. When you say resonance, you mean in the same sense that people talk about an ammonia molecule or something sort of bouncing up and down?
That's right, mm. Yeah. But, yes, just, there's just resonance, and all you're doing is measuring the resonance. And so if you look at it in X-rays, you see one set of resonances. If you then put it in another way, you get another set. One of the more intriguing things is that you probably think the half-life of radioactive materials is constant.
I've been told that.
You've been told that, yeah. Well, and you know, it doesn't matter what chemical compound you got with it, or all these other things. Well, my hypothesis is, I'm sure that if you really measured this very carefully, you would find there is a difference, because, of course, there are two different degrees of order of, shall we say, plutonium oxide and plutonium fluoride. And he would say, ah, yes, it might be nearly the same, but because it's in a different environment, it should be different. Well, people have measured this thing, and they have found that there are different half-lives. Half-lives do change.
But it doesn't fit into the theory.
One intriguing one, which is one I was interested in, was not so much the... Well, indeed, the half-life changed, but somebody put... I forget what the material was. It was fairly radioactive material.
Right.
I can't remember exactly what it was. But he put it under a tremendous anisotropic pressure in a press. And he found that the radioactivity was different in one direction to another.
Right, and that would conform with your theory, wouldn't it?
Pardon?
That would conform to your theory.
That would conform to my theory exactly, you see. That once you apply anisotropy, and anisotropy is the most important in my system, that you do change things. And in fact, have you ever heard of Reynolds' number?
Reynolds' number to do with viscosity, yeah.
Yeah, well... Reynolds' number is when all of a sudden you get to a particular figure in it.
Right, and you get a vortex, don't you?
It gets turbulent.
Yeah.
Well, when you look at that and you just think about it a little bit more, what you're doing is applying more and more anisotropy to the system, aren't you?
Yeah.
And what happens is, and this is the bit that is very difficult to understand, and you can see why you can never quite prove it. What happens is that all of a sudden it changes into a slightly different phase. The water breaks down into threads.
Yeah.
And it's the threads that muddle themselves up because they become a type of powder.
You're saying it's actually
hence, of course, that you have an enormous change in its viscosity system.
Are you saying that's a phase change?
You stop to measure it, it goes back straight away.
Yes. Are you saying that is the same phase change?
It is a phase change, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's a phase of water, which is a bit like the biological ones. In other words, it's in bits. But as soon as you stop, it changes.
Right.
Again, a little bit like the amoeba. When it leaves a bit behind, it changes back.
So you found yet another phase change?
Oh, yes. There are more and more. Once you get down to looking at these things, you find out there's more and more of them.
Oh, God. Hey, look, have you got any of the stuff written down? Can I send you a hefty stamped address envelope or something? Or is it?
Well, I'll look you something up, and you can read it through, and if I ask for it back, I'll ask for it back. You can get the photocopies of it. If I don't ask for it back, you can keep it and pass it on to somebody else. But I don't know where you live, so...
I'll give you my address.
Right, I've got a piece of paper.
Okay, it's Ray West.
Oh, not Western, I've put Western.
W-E-S-T. Ray is actually R-A-E. A-E.
A-E, I got that wrong as well.
Okay, 58... Littleton Road. That's Little T-O-N Road.
like Humphrey Rittleton.
Yeah, I think so. Ashford.
Ashford.
Middlesex. This is not the Kent one. And the postcode...
Ah, yes. I thought I'd heard of it.
Yeah, the postcode is TW15.
That's Twickenham.
Twickenham, yeah.
Twickenham
near Heath.
15.
1UQ.
1UQ.
Can I just briefly ask you how Ivor Katz got in touch with you, or how you got in touch with him? Was that through Wireless World?
Well, I think I saw something that he'd written and I wrote to him.
That was in Wireless World, was it?
Probably in Wireless World many years ago.
Yeah, because Wireless World seems to be a sort of maverick.
That's right, yes. I haven't read it for years now.
Have you published
yours? Once I retired, I pulled out of many of these things.
Have you published any of this? Or have you found it? I mean, Katz's theory is that you would find it very difficult to get it published.
Very, very difficult. I mean, say, Professor McClintock is in charge of superfluid helium, and and I know him quite well, he's a nice, charming fellow.
Is that at the Cavendish or something like that?
Pardon?
Is that at the Cavendish?
No, he's at Lancaster University.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's a nice, charming fellow, but he just sticks religiously to it, but he realises that... superfluid helium and solid helium, but
does he teach that to his pupils?
It would destroy the whole of the quantum theory.
Right.
But then I asked them, well, what is this quantum theory? And the quantum theory is to be found in the book of Genesis, the quantum theory, and God saw the light. And then it says in the book of Genesis that it is good, but the word good is really what we mean by the word quantum. It is exactly as it is.
Mm.
And that is, so in other words, you can say that in the book of Genesis he said, and God saw the light, that it was quantized.
You're saying that it's basically a religious belief of these people, that in the quantum theory?
Do you think the same is true? They stick to it, and...
do you think that's true of the Big Bang theory as well, that it's a kind of religious a creation story?
Big Bang, anything of over 2,000 years old is beyond my ken. I don't worry too much about my former history.
I see.
In other words, I like to be able to measure something here and now, rather than have a lot of guesswork of what might have happened.
How long have you developed this your theory over?
I came across it. It was entirely as a result of doing some work with plutonium urania, and I came across a very peculiar effect in that, which I thought, that's very funny. That shows Bragg's theory of solids is wrong. And I was away at a place called St. John's in the Vale, near Keswick. Look it up on your map.
Right.
And I'd got a pile of children with me, some of whom were from an approved school. They taught me a lot. God blimey.
But not about physics.
School lads are clever. And when I woke up in the morning, I said, the answer to my problem is resonance, hence of course why it's got resonance in it. And then the nuclei with an equal number of degrees of freedom resonating, and we all talked of electron clouds, so I fed in an electron. And so the following day, I changed it to order, and from there onwards, I've studied it ever since.
What year was that?
I think it was the 31st of May, 1964. Now, if you just hold on a moment...
That's exactly 25 years ago.
Yeah, it was donkey's years ago.
Well, it's exactly 20...
Yes, it was born on the 31st of May, 1964.
That's 35 years ago, isn't it?
35 years ago, and I've never changed the principle since then. I've never had to change the principle. All I've done is keep finding out that first one thing after another is not quite right, and when you analyse what you know, I've read the original papers of Andrews on this critical point. The man I really admire is Sir William Herschel.
Herschel?
On the Sun. Now, he wrote an article called On the Nature of the Sun. And you see, you probably think, as I thought, that the sun is jolly hot.
Right.
You think it's a million degrees centigrade. It must be more than that in the middle. But Sir William Herschel...